I'm Steve Hitchcock, and it's Thursday afternoon, August 23rd, and my topic is mismanners and ministry in the marketplace, civility and politeness as signs of the kingdom. Some of you have been in a number of the sessions that I've been offering this week on the topic of ministry of the laity, and this is part of that continuing series. As I share with many of you, my work that pays the mortgage each month is to serve as a consultant to nonprofit organizations, primarily in the areas of fundraising and governance. And I work with museums and conservation organizations and some schools. One of my principal volunteer activities, my vocation, if you will, or avocation, is to work with an organization called New Models for Ministry, which is an effort of a number of people in Northern California, principally Episcopalians and Lutherans, to get at the issue of ministry of the laity, but to talk about it in its original sense, namely that ministry of laity means ministry of people of God. And all of us are God's people, whether we function as clergy or function, for lack of a better word, as laypersons. And to talk about the context of ministry rather than the function of ministry, and the context is everyday life. I brought these. I don't want to take them home. So if you didn't get a copy and would like one, take one. And if you would like to continue to receive this newsletter from New Models for Ministry, just write your name and address and zip code printing, and I'll be glad to see that you continue to receive it. There's no obligation or some kind of subscription or anything. So if I could just hand those to you.
Yes.
Here's a pencil.
Now that was made the other day.
Yes, that's the same one. Same one, but there's different folks here, so if you didn't get those, please do. Those of you who have been with me know that my style is to be interrupted. I enjoy that. And the ground rules are simply that we try to be concise when we speak. We avoid some of the opportunities to be argumentative just for the sake of arguing. Often those are better dealt with over coffee later on. And finally, that we strive to listen to each other as participants, to learn from each other. Let me just tell three short stories and then have a chance for you to talk with me about this topic of civility and politeness. There's a group in New Jersey called Suburban Avengers. Have any of you heard of them? Suburban Avengers, they live in the suburbs of New Jersey. And they drive around parking lots and where cars are parked in handicapped zones and there's not a handicapped license plate or permit, they leave a little sign that says, "This sign means physical handicap." For those people who take up two parking spaces, I don't know if that's a thing to do in your town, but you want to protect your car, so instead of going between the lines, they go over those. So what they do then is take Suburban Avengers go and park as close as possible, about that far away, on each side. The person comes out, of course, aggravated as can be, because she or he cannot get out. And so, miraculously, somebody appears after about 5 minutes of frustration and drives away, and then in another minute, the other person drives away. Well, the third thing the Suburban Avengers do is they go around the countryside and find garbage that's been thrown out. And usually the garbage is thrown out almost invariably. There's an envelope or some other identifying mark, and they deliver it back to the family or person that deposited it on the roadside. Story number one. Story number two is from Miss Manners' book, The Guide to Rearing Perfect Children. Have any of you read that book?
We have it at home. Not yet. But we have finished
It is a delightful book. Do any of you see her column in the newspaper? The book is very, very good. It is also a very good piece of child-rearing advice. She is more than humorous. She's thought a great deal about the topic, and I encourage you to read the book. Well, she talks about the perfectly modern dilemma of what to do about two persons who are living together, who come to visit their parents, even though they're not married. What do you do? Does anybody know Miss Manners' answer to that? Well, pardon?
I said no, but I know what my mother does.
What does your mother do?
She lives in a different bedroom.
Right. That's Miss Manners' advice. Put them in separate bedrooms.
She says they're rude to come like that.
Pardon?
She says they're rude to come like that.
Miss Manners doesn't, you don't say anything, you just put them in separate bedrooms. And then her advice is that a good host or hostess then does not check to see whether or not both beds have been slept in. Nor does one worry about someone who seems to get lost coming back from the bathroom and ends up in the wrong bedroom. Story number two. Story number three is really just a brief anecdote. Have any of you seen the bumper stickers that say, "I'm the mommy"?
No.
Okay. What that means is the answer in Ms. Banner's book about, in terms of child rearing, when children ask, "Why do I have to go to bed at 8 o'clock? The answer is, "I'm the mommy." Well, those are just three brief stories. The reason those stories to me are important and the issue of civility is, number one, the Suburban Avengers story. I feel very strongly that civility is important to the preservation of our sense of public space, to our sense of public well-being. It's just a I'm not very good at etymology, but at least I know this, that civil is related to civitas, which means community. My contention is there can be no community, whether that community is in church, at home, in our homes, or in our workplace, or in the communities in which we live, our neighborhoods, our cities, our states and national government. There can be no community without civility. My own feeling, as important as I believe it is to work for peace and justice and be involved in global issues, my own sense is that we're much more likely to die or kill the planet off, if you will, drown in our own litter before we suffer a nuclear holocaust. I have the sense that the litter we drop in some ways is more devastating than the bombs that we drop. Or maybe the bombs we drop or do drop or could drop can happen only because we're inconsiderate enough to drop litter. But there's an African saying that I think is apropos, where it says, "Sweep your own doorstep and you clean the whole world." And I think it's that sort of Wolf and Worf, the reciprocal part of being involved as Christians in global issues, but knowing that some of the trivial ones are just as important. The second story about what to do with cohabiting, or whatever one wants to call folks who live together, as and I don't want to argue the morality one way or the other, but I think Miss Manners' point for us as Christians is terribly important, namely the importance of standards. I think her insight into human behavior is that one does not adjust standards to reality, but reality adjusts to standards. Now, certainly there are times that it's important to be flexible, times that are important to be adaptive, times that are changed. None of us wants to be around a crusty curmudgeon that never gives in. And in a sense, Miss Manners is flexible with her advice, but she raises up the standard. I think she's the other thing that in the book that's sort of this repeating motif, that the appropriate response to inappropriate behavior, to brutish, stupid things, is always surprise. Even if the person's done it 100 times, you act surprised that anyone could possibly do that. The third story about I'm the Mommy. Those of us who have been parents know what happens when you give an explanation. The reason that you should go to bed at 9:30 tonight is because we're concerned about the fact that you get a good night's sleep. What's the response? Why do I need a good night's sleep? That's the trouble with why questions. There's never really any answer, is there? Finally, it sort of becomes a self-defeating, if you will. I think that, for me, this sometimes explanations are inappropriate of behavior really gets at a larger issue of ministry in everyday life, an issue that I think for those of us who are Lutherans, we have a leg up, if you will, on some other Christians. As Luther kept reminding us, we are simultaneously, or at the same time, both sinners and saints. Now, what Luther means is not one second you're a sinner and next second you're a saint. No, he means at the same time we're both sinner and saint. When our behavior appears to be, and perhaps is, most saintly, at that same time we are also sinful human beings. What I think that means is, to go back to the Miss Manners explanation, is sometimes motives for human behavior are not worth discussing. Because our motives, as Luther reminds us, are always mixed. We're always acting out of self-interest. We're always acting in a selfish, if you will, manner, even at those times when we're seemingly acting in a saintly or polite manner. I think the other point that's important about sometimes explanations for behavior are not necessary is that ambiguity can be anxiety producing. Any of us who have raised parents, or any of us who have supervised other people, and if you've done both, sometimes you don't know which you're doing. Sometimes when I went to the publishing company, I said, gee, this sounds just like a conversation I had with my child last night. Shouldn't things be different here at the office? No, they're not. As Elmer Witt reminded us last night, none of us really grows up. We just get taller. Our childhood behavior stays with us. Well, anyway, sometimes ambiguity can be anxiety-producing. And I think that part of our ministry in everyday life is to say, what issues are worth creating anxiety about? And I think some of the issues of civility and politeness are not worth creating anxiety about. To set standards and to abide by those standards can be helpful, can be anxiety reducing. Children really do appreciate the security of knowing, yes, I have to go to bed at 9 o'clock, no questions asked. They don't like it, in one sense. But again, as Elmer reminded us, who said that happiness was what life was about? Well, those are just some introductory remarks. You folks came here. There were lots of other good choices. You could have found out why we ate the food we did. You could have listened to Ron Sider talk about pro-life agenda, social justice. What about this topic is of interest to you? Why are you folks here? What do you want to talk about in terms of manners and politeness? We've got about 40 minutes, and I'm willing to, you've heard what my perspective is, I'm willing to listen to you, talk about the topics that you want to talk about. What's of interest to you? Who cares about this?
What'd you call them? The Avengers?
Suburban Avengers?
It'd just be consideration for people. If everybody would just be considerate.
Okay.
Just make things a whole lot easier for us.
Okay, good point. Let's talk about why that's important and why we don't. Okay, any other topics? Yeah.
How you would, from a Christian perspective in a business environment, perhaps represent Christian attitudes about communications with other people, but yet be assertive and do what is proper and
good,
not have them waste your time and just tell them to get lost. I mean, it's kind of a dilemma there between telling them to, you know, go away and don't bother you versus being a good Christian and,
yes,
what can I do for you kind of thing.
Yes. Good point. Yes, please.
In a church where sometimes manners and the way of doing things become set in stone and there's no give and take or flexibility so that people feel that it's done this way, so it shall always be done this way, and it even gets in the way of being truly Christian and truly loving.
Good. Okay. Yes. In one sense, as persnickety as Miss Manners sounds, what she's really trying to do is to say, manners aren't set in stone. Just because Amy Vanderbilt said that's the way it is, doesn't mean that that's the way it has to be forever. Good. Other topics about civility and politeness? Other concerns you've had? Things you disagree with?
Well, how you change that behavior with manners. I mean, not to attack them and, you know.
Okay. Anything else? I can write quickly and talk quickly. Yes, please.
In general, how to deal with confrontation, but with manners.
Okay. Good point, because one of the reasons that we have manners is to deal with difficult situations, isn't it? Because if left to our own devices, killing them. Other topics, other things that interest you, other experiences you've had with manners and politeness, civility or lack thereof. Okay, well, let's talk about these and just take that as the agenda for the next 40 minutes, and I'll be glad to do that, and I hope you'll jump in if you suggested these topics and say, no, you didn't answer my question, or if you have contribution. I think that some of you may have read the great English novel called Emma by Jane Austen. Which is a book about Victorian manners. But I think Jane Austen surpassed or went beyond Victorian manners. But that the great tragedy, according to Jane Austen, was that Emma was impolite. And to be impolite was to do what? Why is it such a travesty to be impolite? Yeah.
Because you upset others.
Yes. Somebody else gets hurt. And manners are the way in which, as we were saying before, we keep ourselves from hurting other people. One of the important New Testament principles or understandings, and certainly one that Luther sought, other than that, and is very contrary to the modern sensibility, is that love for Luther, and I think for St. Paul, was not an emotion. Love didn't have very much to do, if anything at all, with motivation. Love was action, or even more specifically, love was the result of our behavior. And for Luther, that result was that somehow the neighbor's best interest was looked out for. As Luther would repeatedly said, we love God by loving the neighbor. And obviously he had read the New Testament and the Gospels. The way in which we love God is to love our neighbor. And that doesn't mean that we have nice feelings for our neighbor. That doesn't mean that we're motivated all the time by this tremendous romantic, erotic emotion, but that there are results in our neighbor's life. Some of you may have read Luther's explanation of the Ten Commandments, and that concern for neighbor is very strong. Well, why don't we do that? Why are we impolite? Or if we're not impolite, why are all those Philistines out there impolite?
Selfish.
Hey, Mom. Why else?
In a hurry.
In a hurry? Pardon?
I said time.
Time. Time bomb?
Or lazy.
Lazy?
Because everybody else is.
Because everybody else is.
It's reaction to other people's
behavior. Okay.
Instead of the good. Spreading the bad spreads through the good people.
Okay. Are there any other reasons, at least in contemporary society, why we're impolite?
Ignorance.
Ignorance?
Okay. Stress.
Stress?
Yeah.
But we just haven't been taught.
Haven't been taught?
The models and TV and so forth are not to be this way. And
right.
Rambo gets his way. And
yes.
And that kind of a thing.
Yes.
And so the modeling, we haven't had good models.
Yeah. One of the important things about TV, which I do think shapes our culture to such a dramatic degree, and watching my children watch TV, is that they're obviously appealing to children, and children always win. Adults on TV, if you look at them, parents are mostly buffoons who should be dealt with impolitely. I guess it sells cereal or something. Yes, any other reasons for... Okay, inability to empathize. Why can't we empathize? What makes it so hard to empathize with others?
Well, you'll get involved, and sometimes you don't want to be involved.
Okay, you want to stay, you want to keep your distance. The reason that Jane Austen was so cruel was that her background and her experience didn't give her the ability to empathize. She couldn't put herself in the shoes of other people because she hadn't been there. Anything else? Yes?
Anger, spitefulness.
Okay, spitefulness. Sometimes our negative emotions become so strong. We live in the Bay Area, in San Francisco Bay Area, and there one is impressed daily, if not hourly, by the incredible cultural diversity. When we were in Indiana, we signed our kids up for school. Boom, boom, boom. We come to California, we go to sign our kids up for school, and the third question down, which of these languages does your child speak at home? And they listed 16 different languages. I counted them. They don't ask that in Indiana. But one of the reasons I think that there are, that one of the reasons that we have difficulty in our time being polite, being civil, if you will, is that we live in an era of incredible cultural diversity. And what is polite in one culture is impolite in another. And so that the need to be more sensitive and the difficulty of empathizing is greater. Any other reasons that we're inconsiderate? Yeah?
Certainly all of these reasons mentioned point to a complete... almost a disintegration of community, and therefore you have no civility. The community is very close-knit.
Mm-hmm.
The family unit even is not real close anymore.
Mm-hmm.
The church group forms a koinonia, a fellowship, but that's not close the way it was 10, 20 years ago.
Right.
And all of these reasons mentioned, stress and anger and, mm-hmm. and distrust and loneliness and all of these things, feed into that, which creates the complete breakup of community. And it's very, very difficult to wear around the gospel or the law or whatever to bring God, to bring community together again.
Right. I think it's a very good point, and one that, frankly, I hadn't thought about. I'd always thought of the flip side. But what the implication are, then there aren't models, as you say.
Right.
There aren't those subtle teaching of behavior that's so important. I think the flip side of that, though, is that those of us who are Christians have civility as one of the ways in which we can begin to create community. And the challenge, then, is to do that. Let me just maybe say a few things that might be helpful at getting at how could we come up with that kind of civil behavior. In my work and in my reading and reflection, I've perceived at least three things, particularly as you mentioned in the business world, how do you handle matters delicately. And these aren't the final list, but I think that there are at least three key things that people want or need. And sometimes they don't distinguish between those two. I found that people want to be listened to. They want to be able to tell their story. One of the things that New Models for Ministry has always contended in the 5 years that we've been in existence is the church doesn't take time just to listen to lay persons, just to hear their stories. Back in Indiana, I edited the parish newsletter, and I thought, gee, it'd be great to say what somebody was doing in their life. You know, they have these little vignettes about people's awards and special events in their lives. Well, so I'd call up every month and say, well, what about so-and-so? What does he do? Or what's her job? And finally, after a couple months of these questions, the pastor's response was, Steve, you know, I really try to keep those mundane details out of my head. Now, I understood why he did that, and he was a very good pastor. But on the other hand, I think that both in the workplace and in our family, we all have that sense that we're not being listened to. And I'd like to suggest that that's one way, and perhaps the easiest way, to be considerate of others, is just to take time to listen to them. The great fear, what's the great fear about listening to people? At least the fear I have. Maybe you
get
have.
Get too involved.
Get too involved.
Tell you what you don't want to hear.
Tell you what you don't want to hear. Anything else about listening to others?
It might change your mind.
Might change your mind.
Might get some gossip.
Might get some gossip. My big fear always is it's going to take too much time.
That's for sure.
Yeah, and you say, that's for sure. But again, to use the child rearing model or even the supervisory model, the failure to take that time ends up in a blow up later on. There's a neat little model that I can show you that does that. So we have to take the risk of investing the time to listen to people. And one of the things that I've found is if you just say, all I'm going to do is listen, and try to listen well and say, yeah, I understand, people who have that sense of being listened to speak more briefly than those people who feel they're not being listened to. If someone feels he or she is not being listened to, they will tend to repeat themselves. That's why young people complain about old people rambling. It's a young person's own fault because they're not listening to the elder, to their elders, and therefore the elderly person keeps repeating himself or herself. Well, number one, to be listened to. Number two, to be recognized and appreciated. There's a little book in the library by Kenneth Erickson, Take Time to Praise, I think, is it? It's Against That Wall. Erickson used to be on the board of directors here. A very good point. Number three, to experience cheerfulness. One of the things that I found in terms of trying to be considerate of others and working with others is that criticism never, never works. It may make you feel better, but it really doesn't change human behavior. What do people learn to do when they're being criticized? Pardon? They tune out?
Angry.
They become defensive, and what
self-defensive?
I said angry.
Angry. Feel sorry for themselves? They learn not to get caught again. But positive behavior only happens when people are recognized and appreciated for that behavior that you want to happen. The other thing that I've found that that's always amazed me in the world of work is that if you're cheerful, people, it's contagious. I've just walked into the office so often, and it's sort of like everybody decided that they were going to get up and be gloomy that day. I don't know what it is out there in the drinking water in the world.
Showing him. How are you going to do that?
What do you do?
I criticize him.
Does it work?
To some extent. I get criticized myself. I mean, sometimes you get both praise and criticism now.
It seems to me that, to go back to this matter of civility, that that you have to get agreement on the standards of what the behavior is. And I think that that's the point at which one is not aggressive, but at least assertive. This is what I expect, and is in terms of children or any other adults, that these are what my expectations are. These are my standards, that people who aren't married sleep in separate rooms. And to get some sort of assent at that level of that. And then I guess I've always found that it's helpful to say, what do you need to be able to reach that standard? If this is a standard you agree on, what can I do that will help you, or what do you need from others to achieve?
Areas of improvement, but
right.
In a manner that you would not consider to be a criticism.
Right. I mean, yeah, I just, what do you need? And in that sense, and say, hey, you've screwed up, but what do you need to reach this? And you go.
Yeah, I think that criticism is unavoidable, but I think there's a distinction to be made between criticizing acts and criticizing a person.
Mm-hmm.
And I think criticism of individuals' acts is quite acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
Criticism of the person himself is probably not.
I think that's very, very important. It's difficult to keep those.
Yeah.
It's sort of like God doesn't hate the sinner, and he hates the sin. Well, that's true in one sense, but it's also true that God hates both. But I think that's where manners are helpful, because manners help us focus on behavior and not on the person. Eat with your fork. That doesn't say you're a slob. It just says eat with a fork. Yes?
I find that neat too.
Okay. That's a good disagreement. You find it's more helpful to say, this is what I expect, and this is what you will do.
And this is what you have done. That's not acceptable. Now. Mm-hmm. Here's how. And then we'll work to find out if that change.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there is brutal criticism in there.
And that's
not just criticism, but brutal criticism.
Yeah. That has not worked well for me, and I'll just say that, and different things work for different people. I find it much more helpful to say, what are you going to do to change, and how are you going to change?
Oh, I asked that question also.
Because we do know from studies consistently, managers and people who are employees, there's anywhere from a 25 to a 50% discrepancy on agreed upon objectives.
Mm-hmm.
And unless you're able to close that discrepancy, there's always going to be this sense of I'm being dealt dirty, or there's inconsideration.
Yeah. So it's helpful to have constant evaluation going on, and
yes,
the employee be involved in that evaluation,
right,
rather than coming up after several months of inadequate work to come back and say, I'm sorry, you'll have to go because your work hasn't, just totally
sure,
out of surprise.
Right. Yeah. Very good, because I think that, it's just good insight.
In a classroom, of course, you can't handle kids by being critical and knocking them down.
Right.
This is just so hard for them to understand. So it has to be a constructive criticism all the time.
Right.
And many of them don't get that, of course, at home. And so it has to be developed at school for them to survive.
If we are going to accept Luther and Paul and the New Testament that the way we love God is to love our neighbor, how do people feel loved? And most people, at least in Western civilization, feel loved when their identity is affirmed. And it doesn't do that. I was going to say the third thing I usually do with a difficult employee is to agree on a deadline with them. Not only what do you need to do to improve, but when is that improvement going to take place, and what are the implications for not meeting that deadline?
It gets worse in the government because
yes.
When it comes to that point, you don't say, have you thought of looking for other employment? That really isn't a real viable option to have.
Mm-hmm.
The more viable option is to promote them elsewhere.
Yes.
Really?
Give them to somebody else.
Or you just take, you don't let them do that work anymore, but he stays there.
I found that employees will do only what they want to do. And the difficult challenge for a manager in any office situation or any working situation is to find out what employees really want to do and to help them do it. And the difficulty is that we live in a reality where people end up in the wrong jobs. And what do you do with them then? I think it's just you keep carving it up until you can find out what in the world it is that they really want to do. You had a comment in the back?
I just feel that you're less than, not you, but
yes.
Overall, you're less than honest if you don't lay it right out on the line, which does involve criticism, because ultimately, not county government work, but in the private sector, ultimately, if a person doesn't want to react their way, you're going to have to let them go.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, I think, dishonest to kind of la-di-da along and then one day
yes.
to say, Harry, you're through, and Harry turns to you and says, why didn't you say something?
Right.
And it would be a legitimate, I feel,
yes.
complaint on his part.
Yeah, it would be tremendously inconsiderate.
Yes.
Yeah. It's okay. Good manners. Any other?
I'd like to, this is curious on my part, either in the business world or in a personal family relationship, you may question to the person so that they know what you're expecting as expectations. You can ask them, you can say, these are the expectations and what do you suppose that you can do to that. But the other person always has the option of not participating in this process.
Mm-hmm.
Of saying, I don't know, I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
So you can give them consequences and they can say, well, it's all right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then where do your manners fit in and how
yeah.
do you handle it?
Well, I don't know. I've always, those of you who know I live by pictures because one of the reasons I live by pictures is because when you get angry and upset, you need to slow down mentally. And so these pictures at least help me slow down mentally. And I've always liked Tom Gordon's from effectiveness training, you know, where, but I always have to pervert these symbols into something. I think of this as a layer cake. And some of you may remember from parent effectiveness training. My problem, your problem, and what I always think of is the gooey inside, the part that makes life worth living in a layer cake, the stuff that always stays moist, is a shared or a common problem. And I think what you're describing there is often we get trapped by either trying to make our problem someone else's problem or we get trapped the other way by making their problem our problem. And I think that, that's often, in there's a book called Dealing with Difficult People, which is very helpful. I don't, is it in this? I think Augsburg puts it out. I guess it's not listed in there. But often difficult people that you describe will try to make their problem your problem. The reason I can't perform well at work is that my children are blah, 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 and you've probably heard lots of those excuses. I think what they're doing is trying to say, my problem is your problem. And the challenge is to say, where are those problems shared? And maybe the way to talk about that is to say, the reason my expectations are this way is because we share this turf, if you will, this chocolate frosting in the middle. Is that helpful enough at all? The problem is that you have opened yourself up to that playing that role with them. I mean, that someone, if we get skilled at that, we have to be vulnerable and be on the receiving end. Any questions about this or any comments? You talked about representing Christian values and communication, and I believe you raised that issue, and we've been talking about that. Are there some other, what do you mean by Christian values? Maybe that there's something more beyond that.
It goes more beyond personnel issues. Or, many of us could be involved in areas where you're making judgmental decisions for the employer that you represent. That decision you make is out of many possible decisions that could be made. And you may be dealing in with another party who will become very argumentative over why are you doing that instead of this or whatever, and you start getting into this perpetual cycle of having to review, defend, and at some point you just want to cut it off and say, you know, we decided this, and this is our rationale, and go away, I'm out of time. That's it.
I'm the daddy. That's the way it's going to be.
Well, yeah, that type of thing.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes if you come on too strong, it would appear that you're being un-Christian, you're being uncivil, you're not being polite or anything, but yet you may feel that, gosh, how many times I got to tell the guy?
Yes.
Or how many letters I got to write him or send him, or how many times I got to call him on the phone. So at some point, you want to just say, this is it. Not how can you be looking for ways to do that but yet maintain kind of the Christian values of, well, being nice to you and trying to be responsive. And we're all here in this big happy world together, but
just
got to charge on down the road, too.
Yeah. I guess my perspective in trying to just grapple with this issue as a layperson of what does it mean to be a Christian in the marketplace or in the office place or even in a family and in a community. To me, the value of being a Christian is more an internal experience than it is an external. That for me, to get through that situation, it's more, in one sense, more important to be a Christian than that other people know that I'm a Christian. And sometimes I think we get caught up in feeling either guilty or proud that people do or do not know that we're Christians. And I think it's more important to do that. Joe Sittler, who some of you may know, a marvelous man who now is blind and still, though very creative, talked one time about the Christian is really a debonair person. And he went back to the French, debonair meaning to live as though you have no cares. I think, in a sense, having been in many of those dilemmas where you've got six or seven vendors who want to know why you've made a decision to choose one vendor over another, and that sense of having no cares, that in one sense you can be insensitive. And the only way, as Sittler would contend, that you can be that insensitive is to know that your identity is rooted and grounded in Jesus Christ. And I think that that's, for me, as corny as that may sound, is still the key to ministry.
You may sit and do an honor and disobey, but yeah, internally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The other thing that I find tremendously helpful in that is to know I think the English language is really symbolic of many of the more profound communication problems we have at a much more psychological or emotional level. And there are in the English language, when most of us talk, we use 500 words. That's the way they wrote today's English version. They took the language that most of us use. And what is really interesting, whether you're an academic or a scholar, or whether you're a blue-collar worker, we all tend to use the same 500 words. The range may be slightly expanded, but not very much. There are a few exceptions of people, but most of us use 500 words in our everyday language. The problem we have is that those 500 words have 14,000 commonly accepted standard definitions. What that means is that the odds, what that means is the odds for making a mistake in communicating with another person is very, very high. And the reason I say that's symbolic is I think that most of us who have either been parents, who have served on church boards, who have been active in the community or been involved in business, will know that really what we have are not 500 absolute good or bad decisions. We have 14,000 possibilities, most of which are somehow less bad than some others. We're always, as one person said, yeah, I hear all these sermons that come off as black and white, but what do you do when you're trying to choose between shades of gray? And most of life seems to be, for Christians who I think are active in the marketplace, is how do we choose between shades of gray? And I think that's what forgiveness is really about, is being able to say, hey, most of the time, I'm going to make the wrong decision. Most of the time, something I do, as I once said, yeah, my job around here is to make the decisions that make everybody else unhappy. And often as a parent, you feel that's your job too, is to make decisions that make children unhappy. And I think that concept of forgiveness is tremendously important, to know that forgiveness is not just something that happens on Sunday morning, but that is a daily experience. Any other comments about that, either representing Christian values and trying to do that in communication with others? The next thing seems to say set in stone behavior, how to respond politely. You offered the example of the church. Do you want to say a little bit more about that?
Well, just anytime any kind of change in the worship service is thought of, there's a lot of resistance that they will not like it, or that it will affect people's proper worship, that they won't be able to receive communion because they will be so upset by the change.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, no one ever takes the blame themselves and says, I won't like it. Mm-hmm. It's always some imaginary older person in the church that's going to resist the change.
Okay. What's a polite response to that kind of? There's a good friend of mine, Vic Schoonover in Omaha, and they had a woman pastor come back in the early 70s, and he had this woman, you know, said, well, these people would just come to me, and, you know, finally I realized what the appropriate response was. He said, I can really tell your concern. Which congregation would you like me to transfer your membership to? So that may be indeed the polite, appropriate response. Given, yes?
I would try to pin them down to, I think it's real important we find out about who is
a guest, or who do you think maybe would be key people I can talk to
mm-hmm.
that would be the ones that would object, and I'll see how they feel about mm-hmm. it if I talk to them individually. Then they're pinned down. This just happened to me not long ago, and it was actually the person I was talking to.
Mm-hmm.
But she gave me two other people that were, she respected their opinions very
good.
Strongly. And so I talked with them and got the okay from them. And then got back to her, and she still had to have a kind of hang up. Don't mm-hmm. leave it plugged in all the time, or whatever it happened to be, you know. If you get specific information
mm-hmm.
and then deal specifically with those people that they respect.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. And also working within the power structure, working through the church council
mm-hmm.
can be very effective too.
Yeah, I think that I guess the appeal that I would go back to is to use my model again. And I think that's what you did, is to say, we're a community. And also to say, gee, who should I talk with? And, you know, maybe you should talk with so-and-so who is part of our community. As my son says, why do we have to do everything every Sunday? In terms of the Sunday worship, my son's part of the community. And to help broaden who it is that's going to be served by the worship, the behavior.